From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is happening in the city of Rochester, where there is a lot that is changing. And if you're a city engineer, hopefully a lot that is exciting. The Interloop project is ready to move forward, whether you like it or not. And plenty of people do. You might not, but we're going to talk about that. There's also a two-way conversion project that's going on. And the city is becoming more bicycle-friendly. All of these things are in our targets as we talk for the first half hour this hour with Jim McIntosh, who's the Rochester City Engineer. And first of all, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, the last time we talked a few months back, there were a lot of questions about the timing of the Interloop project and if anything could derail it. Well, here we are in mid-October. And where do things stand now with the Interloop project?
All right. Well, since we last talked, we've actually awarded the contract to a firm, construction firm, who is going to start the work sometime in mid-November. So the first...
About a month from now, then.
About a month from now. The first outward sign we're going to see of that is the Interloop closing, the lower section closing between Monroe Ave and Main Street. And all the work in this first year will mostly happen in that lower section, demolition, relocation of utilities, those kind of things. And then probably the first sign at the surface we'll see is the demolition of the Broad Street Bridge, which is one of the three bridges that'll be taken out as part of raising that road up.
When it comes to this work now, what is the timeline? So you're going to start about a month from now. But
right.
The actual filling, which is sort of so fascinating to so many people, doesn't happen until next year.
Yeah, it happens in the summer. Kind of have to have some conditions, not particularly wet, those kind of things, so that you get the right compaction and all of those technical things so that the road, once you do fill it in, and also some of the areas that will end up being developable land, that they don't sink later.
Why start now, then? Why not wait until next year entirely?
Sure, it's about a... three-year project, although the contractor we have is talking about trying to shorten that time frame up. We'd certainly be happy with that. There's a lot of things ahead of time that they have to do. There's some demolition within the Interloop that they have to do so that it doesn't become a bathtub, essentially, once we fill it. And there's some utilities that have to move, and some of those are major utilities, county sewer lines, pure water sewer lines, and some water lines of ours. And there are private utilities, RG&E and Time Warner and Frontier all have utilities they need to move.
If you have any questions, and this is a good wonky half hour we're spending with Jim McIntosh, this is the time to ask them. You can call toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I was asking Jim before we started if this is a project that is unique in your career, in that you're often building, sometimes bulldozing before you build, but this is a fill, and you said there was sort of a model or at least a learning experience with another project.
Sure. The other one that we did was the filling of the Broad Street Tunnel, that section between Broad Street and Main Street, which finished up probably about 4 years ago. That project had a long time to develop because there was questions about do we fill it, will we use it for a subway, all those kind of things. But it was very similar in that it was an underground area, although it was a tunnel that was filled so that the road above, we kept having to spend money every year to the tune of $500,000 to repair that tunnel, and there was really no use for it. And so that was the reason behind that one. But it was also one where we had to employ these same techniques about bringing in fill, getting good compaction, and we've been fortunate that there have been no incidents of settling, out on that stretch of the road, and the project has been great.
Jim's always very careful to gently correct the media when we talk about the Interloop project. It's not all of the Interloop. It's about a third of it, the eastern third?
Sure, the eastern third, kind of that section that runs north pretty much between Monroe Avenue and Main Street. And the area to the... to the west of that, towards Midtown, downtown, that will there'll be 6 acres of land, developable land there. And then we are reestablishing Union Street as a two-way street on the other side, kind of back to how it was, pre-1960s.
And when it comes to the actual fill material, what is it?
DOT, as you might expect, and this is a project that is both federally funded and DOT, does the oversight for federally funded projects. They have a very specific requirement for how many fines and how much stone and all of those kind of things. But it's essentially, run a bank you know, kind of gravel material that you can get compaction, and that'll be test, and you bring it up in, you know, small lifts, 1 to 2 feet at the most, and compact it as you're bringing it up, so that when you're all done, you don't have voids in there, and it does, you know, keep its shape.
You said gravel?
Yeah, it's mostly gravel, stand, you know, stone mix that meets a DOT specification.
But in order to avoid, for lack of a better word, settling, that's why you do the compaction and sort of do it
correct,
layer by layer?
Do it by lifts, right. If you just kind of filled the whole thing up and then ran a device over the top of it, the stuff in the bottom would have a lot of air gaps in it, and over time, mostly after the first rainfall, probably you'd start to see large settlement pieces.
So you said this is a project that could take 3 years.
Yes, the project schedule goes to October of 2017. The contractor has already indicated that he would like to finish up most of the project in 2 years. We're happy if he can do that. There's some of the challenges on the project are that you have some private utilities out there, and they all just found out about it when we got the funding a year ago. So typically we give them 5 years, and it's in our capital plan and all that. So they're scrambling to get their work done as well. But the contractor may, you know, help them in some cases. There's ways he can speed up the process.
Okay. And the last time we talked, there were also questions about whether do you go ahead with filling a third of the inner loop before it's sort of ascertained who's going to be used that new 6 acres, you said?
Yes, just a little over six acres.
And is there a better idea now, and how's that progressing?
Sure. I think we feel that the area is obviously, because of the East End and what's happening there, that it's pretty prime for development. But our neighborhood and business development group actually has an ongoing study right now, which they hope to finish up about the end of December, hoping to kind of ascertain a little more definition around what we want to find there. We think it's going to be a mixture of, you know, shops and business on the first floor and housing on the second floor. There may be some row houses in there, depending on, you know, where you are. But that's the kind of things that they're going to define a little bit more so that they can put out an RFP and get someone in to do that development.
We have a couple of questions that have come in on Twitter. If you want to join the conversation there, it's at Evan Dawson. And the first comes from Mark, who says, as someone who uses the inner loop every day, I thought they would have the better sense not to go ahead with this. And Jim, I know you've heard that from people, but again, I know, and again, this is sort of well-traveled ground, but let's do that. Let's talk about the numbers and why, regardless of whether we think the inner loop, whether it was heavily used or not, whether it's sort of effective or ineffective in terms of separating neighborhoods and all those things, just in terms of actual traffic, break it down for me.
Sure. And I think I've talked to most of the 6,000 people a day who drive that section of the inner loop, a couple of council members among them. But the numbers are, you know, you take a street like Monroe Avenue, 14,000 cars a day. East Avenue, 11,000 cars a day. And both of those are two-lane road sections. And now we have the inner loop. We have 12 lanes, a couple up on top and 6 down below in some spots. And 12 lanes wide in many spots across there, and we have 6,000 cars a day. So close to half of the traffic that's on Monroe, a two-lane road, is we're dedicating 12 lanes. And as you said, besides all the other issues about dividing neighborhoods and all of those kind of things, are the reasons that we're moving towards this, filling this section in particular.
So I've learned something as a talk show host this year. There are certain things that you could do or say that will provoke the opprobrium of some of your audience. I did not know the inner loop would be such a sensitive one. And I mentioned on this program, maybe a few months ago, that I love taking the inner loop because no one's ever on it. And part of what Jim is saying is, I mean, it's not no one on it, but it's less than half that we see in many other parts with that many lanes. And a listener told me they were canceling their membership at WXXI because I was too anti-inner loop. And I said, I'm not anti-inner loop, and I do enjoy using it, but I'm trying to see it from the engineering perspective where you say what's functional, what's not, what's a better use of, et cetera. So at least at East, not the entire inner loop, but the part that you're beginning to fill, 6,000 vehicles a day compared to 14,000 in different spots nearby.
Right, Right. And on streets that are only two lanes wide, we're going to have a three-lane section here, so one lane each direction and a turning lane all the way from Monroe Avenue to Main Street. So.
Have you noticed that people get a little fired up about this?
Yes, I think they do. It's, you know, change is hard for everyone. But I think the opportunity there, this has actually been in the city plan to do this since the 1990s in the Vision 2000 plan that was done then. So well before you and I got into this discussion, you know, this was planned certainly for, you know, that plan called for more of the Interloop to be raised. But certainly this piece has been in the planning stage. Some people are, you know, people on the other side are saying, why did it take so long?
Well, let's get our first call in, see what you've done. This is Tim in Pittsford. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Evan. How are you?
Good.
As someone who loves the Interloop, I still think this is a great idea. And I think one of the big reasons for that, and it sounds small, but making Union Street two ways is going to be a huge help, I think, because it can be frustrating as a one-way street right now. And I thought from the looks of it, it sounds like it's going to look great, and it should be really interesting. The one question I did have, Mayor Warren loves to promote the city, and she should. She's the mayor of it, and she does a great job. I'm crossing my fingers. Is the contractor from New York, I hope?
Yes, he is. This contractor is actually from the Buffalo area, but he is from New York. This contract has a project labor agreement attached to it. He's a union contractor, used to working with union labor. Has worked on projects in this area. His last project was the Jefferson Road work that the state did all along Jefferson Road with all the, you know, added lanes and everything there between West Henrietta and East Henrietta Road. So he's well-versed at this, and he's a New York State contractor.
All right, great. Well, good luck. I look forward to it.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate the call. And there's somebody who maybe is a little like me saying, yeah, when I'm on it, I love buzzing around that thing, but I understand the point that the city engineer is making here. Now, Jim, this is a project that throughout this year we've had a chance to talk to people in other cities where there are Syracuse and others where similar inner loops or those kind of things have become known as kind of neighborhood separators. And there have been questions about other municipalities filling, changing, et cetera. Are you following any of those developments, and are there any projects going on that are kind of parallel to what's happening here?
Sure. We actually are in a little bit of a New York State group about, you know, this, and some of the folks are involved and some down in the New York City metro area, but closer to home in Buffalo, they're talking about sections of the Sajakwita Expressway there, and certainly probably the biggest one that's getting the most press is I-81 in Syracuse, where it comes, you know, right through by Syracuse University. And while that's an elevated section, they're looking at that again because DOT is going to have to spend a lot of money, whether they just fix what is out there because it's, you know, aging, or do something different. And so that one right now is definitely on the radar of everybody in the transportation field.
Here on Twitter, Alan says, please ask Jim about Crossroads Park and the Rock City Park project.
Okay. I think the reference there is to the folks that are looking to put a skate park
the
in
skate
Rochester.
Park.
Right. That is one of the locations that we're looking at. We have a project that we're getting out to a consultant Our hope is to get it out in the next month or so and start that discussion about, is that an appropriate place for the skate park? You know, start to talk to the neighbors about that and have a public meeting. That section of park, if you know it, between Main Street and Andrews, isn't as vital as we'd like to see it. And so, you know, the first part of that study is going to be, what can we do to...
Isn't as vivacious, you mean?
Right.
Doesn't have enough vitality.
Right, vitality. And is, you know, we... It used to be a very, you know, highly functioning park, a lot of people there at lunchtime, those kind of things, and it's kind of grown out of favor. The other thing for us, it's also the roof of our garage, Civic Center garage, not Civic Center, but the Crossroads garage, excuse me. And so as a roof for that garage, we have to do something to the roof, and the upper part is looking kind of tired, and so is a skate park part of that is I believe, what the questioner was asking, and that will be out in the next month or so that request for proposal and get that project started.
We're talking to Jim McIntosh, Rochester City Engineer, about a number of things that are happening in the city. And when I see a caller on the board, our engineer, Dave, lets me know their name and where they're calling from. And this one says Mike on the Interloop. Mike, are you calling from the Interloop?
No, I worked and for many, many years lived within the Interloop. And I just wonder if you could speak to the idea of what will happen about pedestrian. I heard the idea that you'll at some point be talking about bike paths. And what about socioeconomic barriers will be, I believe, torn down when a portion of the Interloop is relieved. I'm hoping it'll be like opening a floodgate, a socioeconomic opportunity.
Go ahead, Jim.
Sure, I don't disagree, and that's some of the things that, you know, we're hoping to see. I think now if you look there, you'll see people actually illegally and dangerously walking across the Interloop at the spots where it is up near the surface. But the other great things we're going to be able to do is kind of make a we're going to have a cycle track that is going to go all the way from Monroe Avenue to Union Street to connect people to the public market. And I think another caller had made that comment about having Union Street be two-way. The one frustration a lot of people have is they come out of the public market, they get to Main Street, and they have to turn one way or the other because they can't cross the street to get to University or stay on Union. And that will go away as well. And certainly the pedestrian piece of that, a lot more places where people can cross and get from the Park Meigs area to downtown is going to be a big piece of what we're going to see there. As Dana Miller, Councilman Miller, has said, you know, it was a moat. I think he's the one that actually coined that phrase 10 or more years ago, and taking that moat out of there, we're excited about what's going to happen with that.
Abby is asking about a two-way street project, and I think apparently missed some of that. So what's going on with two-way conversion right now, Jim?
All right. So the other exciting thing that's happening this Thursday and Friday is the conversion of St. Paul Street in the city and Clinton in the city between Main Street and the Interloop to the north to two-way traffic. November 16th, Thursday, St. Paul will go to two-way traffic, and the next day, Friday, Clinton
October
will.
16th? Or no? You said
October 16th.
You said November.
I said
October.
November. I meant October.
You're talking tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm talking tomorrow.
Yeah.
That project is going to help certainly the bus company with their new facility, but the real genesis of that project is a study that the city did at the request of the St. Paul Quarter Neighborhood Association, who got tired of not having two-way traffic on their street, thought it was more like an expressway. It's tough to tell people how to get to your house. They have to take, you know, a circuitous route, all of those kind of things. And so that kind of was the start of it, the bus company coming in, and that helped them with their facility and how they line their buses up and all that. So we're starting a month ahead of them opening their facility to, A, give their bus drivers a chance to learn how to navigate their new facility, and B, not to have cars and buses all learning how to use this new two-way facility at the same time. The cars will get about a month head start.
Is there any, what's the biggest complication with this kind of a project?
I think the biggest, you know, after the next 2 days of making the change, the biggest complication, you know, for us is going to be just, you know, someone coming back to the area after a long time and, you know, remembering it as two-way and, you know, maybe not paying attention to the signs. I think that's...
But that's quite different than the actual execution of it.
Right.
So it sounds like you're all set with the execution.
I think with the execution, right, the signals are hung, the actual striping's out there. We have barrels to keep the people going in what will be the future direction, you know, that they'll be going. So essentially, you know, in very compressed form, we're going to have two lanes of traffic heading in the direction that used to be the one-way direction, and then one lane of traffic heading the opposite way with parking. And so the roads will still function, you know, very similarly to what they were as far as capacity and all those kind of things. But they will, you know, you will be able to get both ways and move around the city just a little bit easier.
But when it comes to what people are used to, just a note to be careful about that, to not
yes.
be on the wrong side.
Yep. Yeah. Be careful, you know, obey the signs. And I think the first, you know, time or two you get down there, I think you just have to be a little alert and maybe do some defensive driving in case someone else, you know, gets confused with the new configuration.
All right, so they're ready to go there on St. Paul and Clinton in that section. When you mention Union Street, a two-way conversion, that happens when?
Union Street going to two-way, that'll be in sometime in your either next summer or the spring of
2016.
Of 2016, right?
Okay, so
so that'll be the after they fill in the interloop and kind of move those streets around, they'll want to get that section to two-way before they. Actually take out the bridge at Monroe, that will have to happen just so that they have a detour route.
So these are significant changes that you're seeing in the city, and we got a few more minutes left with Jim McIntosh, city engineer. Before we get back to the phones, briefly, you're also working to make the city more bicycle friendly. We've been hearing about things like bicycle boulevards and others. What's going on?
Sure. Thanks to transportation specialist Eric Frisch, we've really come a long way in the bike area, and certainly also with people like Richard DeSera and the folks who are pushing cycling in the city. We've gone from no miles of on-street bike lanes in 2011 to about 60 lane miles of bike lanes at the end of this year. And we had a great start with 30 miles of trails that we had from the river trail piece, and just adding these on-street bike lanes, and the next piece of that is bike boulevards and the cycle tracks that we're adding, one of them on this interloop project and another one that's going to be going in over on Elmwood by the University of Rochester. And that's a bike-only facility, 10 feet wide, bikes in both directions, off the street, street separated. We're going to have one of those along Union Street, and we'll have one over on Elmwood.
When you go from zero bike lanes on street in 2011 to nearly 60 at the end of this year, the question is how seamlessly motorists and bicycles can sort of coexist with more regularity. How are things going there?
I think we have a lot of education to do, and we're working on that. We've been doing a little bit of publicity. There's only so much we can do on, cable channel 12 and those kind of things. We may have to step that up a little bit. Bikes were always allowed to be on the road, and you were always supposed to share the road. I think the bike lanes help both the cyclists know where they should be and help the cars understand that they're on the road. But there's learning on both sides with both the cyclists and cars is to make that safer. And certainly the goal, the cycle track obviously is the ultimate in safety. These bike boulevards we're hoping are going to be the next piece that gets folks who are nervous about the safety when they ride their bikes to use bikes as a means of transit, and something that people are getting back into with health concerns and all those things.
One more call for Jim McIntosh. This is Keith in Farmington. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, how are you doing today?
Good.
I've got a question for you guys. What's the purpose behind all of this, filling in the inner loop and changing the – I can see the changing of the directions of the streets probably to facilitate the buses, but – if you guys think you're going to bring swarms of people back downtown because the interloop is filled in, or if you're going to revitalize downtown Rochester, I mean, Heidi Zimmer Meyer has been trying that for 30 years, and you get little pockets of success like around the Grove and Eastman. But I personally say don't waste it. Take what you got and try to repurpose it without filling it in, such as maybe summer months have a area bicycle race around it, shut it down. I mean, do a lot with it just because it's below ground or below street level. But to fill it in, I just think is a waste.
Thanks for the call, Keith. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, well, great question. I think that gets back to really, why are we spending all this money? Well, when we did this, we were also required under the federal program to do a cost-benefit analysis. And the benefit of not having to repair those bridges or do the replacement of those bridges or the repair of the interloop walls and all those kind of things that will fail over the next, 15, 20 years, which is how far out we looked, outweighed the cost of doing the fill and taking it kind of off the state and federal radar. It'll become a city street. That outweighed that by 2-1 without even counting in any development potential that we have. So I think the cost-benefit piece was there to tell us that this was the right thing to do. Even if it wasn't that it was in the city plan and that we had all these other benefits of unifying neighborhoods and all of those kind of things.
All right, so last question for you. For anybody who missed it, on the Interloop project, you start next month with essentially shutting down a portion. Just walk us through real briefly the timeline again.
Sure. So sometime in the middle of next month, and there'll be signs up a couple weeks prior to that, we'll be closing the section between Monroe Avenue and Main Street. And that will be closed pretty much forever at that point. And we'll start working on raising the inner loop and reestablishing Union Street as a two-way street.
And what are the stops in between those two? I'm trying to think in my head where I've been usually getting.
Okay, so as you get up at Monroe Avenue, that bridge, you know, will stay until near the end of the project. That'll be the last one to go. The next stop you have along the way is East Avenue. Or Broad Street, excuse me, would be the next bridge that you crossed. There's really the next exit that you have would be up, you know, if you're heading from Monroe Avenue, the exit that you have would be up, you know, to Union and Main Street there. And coming from the other direction, you will lose the exit at East Avenue, and you'll lose the exit that gets you up to Monroe Avenue. You'll take the surface streets of Union Street or Pickin to get to those.
All right, so a lot going on. An exciting time. Engineers usually have, we think of as, you know, a lot of hard work and interesting technical stuff. Probably the most exciting time I can imagine for an engineer, Jim.
It is. It's a great time to be me, I guess. And it's very exciting. And I think it's kind of neat as a civil engineer to do things that really benefit the public. And this is a chance for our staff to do something that's really, really interesting. And we can see the positive benefit we're having.
Well, and in all seriousness, I know people do get fired up about certain things and they do have questions, and I appreciate you coming in and answering those questions and giving people the access to get the information. So hopefully we'll see you again as we go throughout this process on this and other projects, and thanks for sharing your time with us.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
Jim McIntosh, Rochester City Engineer. Short break right here on member-supported public radio. Stay with us. Coming up in our second hour, Seattle is joining the movement away from Columbus Day. Instead of honoring Christopher Columbus, Seattle is celebrating Native culture. So we ask, is this trend likely to spread to Western New York? What should our children be taught about Columbus and his voyages? Our expert panel explores the Columbus question next hour.
In his anonymous emails, he called himself Citizen 4.
I hope you understand that contacting you is extremely high risk.
He was Edward Snowden, about to turn over classified information on surveillance programs to filmmaker Laura Poitras.
We were in this hotel room. We knew that there was a clock ticking.
Her new documentary, Citizen 4, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Welcome back to Connections here on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. When we saw this subject come up this week, this was one of those things that I said, we've got to fit this in this week. It's such an interesting concept. The concept of a human library and human books. And we're talking about what's going on this Friday from 2 to 6 in the afternoon at Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. They have, I think if I saw the list, something like 20 human books. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about human books, we're talking about people with very interesting life experience who will act as sort of a human book that you can go to the library and check out. We're going to find out exactly what that means with two of the human books right now. Carol Selinsky's here. She is, and I hope this is the right description, a psychic medium?
Yes, correct.
All right, Carol. And the book description on Carol, if you want to check out Carol on Friday, is the phrase psychic medium invites skepticism and sometimes fear. But this book, this living book, uses her gift to calm and comfort those seeking guidance and strength. Carol explains how communicating with the spirit world can lead to healing. All right, in just a moment, we're going to try to check out Carol a little bit here, and we're going to find out exactly what she means by that. And then we have Mubarak Bashir, who is known as a Muslim peace advocate. So Mubarak, the description is spreading the word about the peaceful nature of the Muslim religion is the key motivation for this community activist from the local chapter of, and tell me about the Muslim community mosque. Where are you from? Ahmadiyya, is that right?
Ahmadiyya Muslim.
Ahmadiyya Muslim. So give me a little bit more on your background.
So my background, I actually come from an interesting background because my parents are actually converts to Islam. My mom was a Jewish convert to Islam and my dad was a Christian convert to Islam. I'm one of seven kids. We're all born Muslim. So we've really seen all different faiths. We grew up learning of all different faiths, which is a requirement of Muslims. So I was born in the Muslim faith. From what I've seen and what I know is that Islam is strictly about peace, which is unfortunate because when you watch things in the media, people get different concepts of what Islam actually stands for.
Did you see a lot of the sparks fly recently on Bill Maher's show on HBO? And Ben Affleck was on there, Bill Maher, writer Sam Harris, Nicholas Kristof, debating the nature of Islam and what ends up sort of either distorting it or representing it. So we'll get into that in just a minute. But again, Mubarak and Carol are two of the human books that you can check out Friday afternoon, 2 to 6, at the Rush Reese Library. And Katie Pappas is here, who is organizing this human library. Where did this idea come from? I think it's fascinating.
Well, that's actually an interesting question. So I'm actually one of the organizers. We have a pretty big team. And the idea for the human library was introduced to us by our dean, the dean of the library, Marianne Mavranek. She came to us from the University of Toronto at Mississauga. Human libraries are fairly popular there, and they started actually in the year 2000 in Denmark. It came out of an anti-violence movement, actually. And so since then, they have really spread all over the world. There have been hundreds of them. And they've slowly made their way into the Western New York area.
And the way it works, if I'm understanding it correctly, is that from 2 to 6 p.m. this Friday at the Rush Reese Library, anyone can come out.
That is correct.
And you just have to show up, and then how do you check out a book? How does the process work?
So the process is actually pretty, it's if you've ever checked out a book at a library, it's very much like that. We use a lot of the library terminology. We'll have a circulation desk right outside of the room that the books will be having their conversations with readers. What you can do is approach any one of our volunteers, look over our catalog. We have a library catalog which lists book titles and book descriptions, and then we have a circulation process. So we're checking books out for a half-hour period. If somebody looks interesting to you, you'll just let us know. We'll set you up with that interview. Sometimes you have to wait. It tends to be a very popular event, I will say that. So definitely come early if you've got some that you're really interested in.
Yeah, and forgive me, Katie, how many years have you been doing it here?
So actually, this is our fourth event.
Okay.
The first one that we did was at the U of R in January of 2013. But we've done four over the course of the last close to 2 years, and we actually even co-sponsored an event back in January with the Rochester Public Library.
All right, so 19 human books.
Correct.
And looking down the list, again, these are the kind of subjects that could be books. They just happen to be people with a life experience. So I'm just going to read down the list before we get back talking to the two human books here. Vietnam veteran, transgender person, Afghan higher education innovator. Fascinating stuff. Busboy to network guy, a girl's story. Third culture kid. A 40-something college graduate. A tattoo artist. A survivor, a homeless single mother to a doctoral candidate. Homeless, hungry, and addicted. Same water, different fish. An ethnomusicologist.
Yes.
Cool stuff there. Did you want to jump in and explain? Do you know what an ethnomusicologist is?
She's actually a faculty member over at the Eastman School. And her story is interesting in that, you know, one of the things the Human Library is designed to do is sort of break down stereotypes and prejudices that might exist in a community. Hers is interesting. She is somebody who teaches at the Eastman School, which tends to have maybe a more classic or a standard curriculum, and she's interested in some composers that are maybe outside of that. So she's sort of dealing with her own kind of interests in a more classic curriculum.
Next one is 21st Century Butler, funny and real stories of life in a wheelchair, connected Wonder Woman, a psychic medium, who we're going to talk to a little bit more in a moment, a male African-American teenager named Emma's Angel, saving a life but not really, a student EMS volunteer, an African-American community activist, a Muslim peace advocate, we're going to talk to Bashir again in just a moment, and Rescue Me, a volunteer fire chief from Ontario County. That's the 19 human books that you can check out from 2 to 6 at the Rush Reese Library on Friday. So, Mubarak, when people come and check you out, right now, they want to talk to you. You are offering a very timely experience and conversation. And the conversation, I don't know if I check you out, do you sort of talk for half an hour? Do we get to chat back and forth? Is that kind of the...
Well, and I can, the books could definitely tell you this, although we have two new participants. It is very much about a conversation.
A conversation.
It is very much about a conversation, and that's why we're so careful when we pick individuals to do this, because it isn't a monologue.
Yeah.
Nobody's preaching to anybody. It is very much, you get to ask what you want, and we have terrific books who are willing to answer just about anything.
All right, so Mubarak Bashir is a Muslim peace advocate, and when you see the conversation that became a firestorm on HBO, in which Bill Maher and Sam Harris were saying that how many Muslims in the world? 1.6 billion, something like that.
Right.
Of course, that not 1.6 billion people are violent or want to hurt other people. But they point to, in some majority Muslim countries, a preference, a majority population preference for imprisonment or death for apostates, and subjugation of women, and all of these things that are happening in what we sort of loosely and maybe inaccurately describe as the Muslim world. What do you say, Mubarak? What do you say to people who are looking at that saying, I don't get it? Because you can't say that you want death or imprisonment for apostates and say that you're peaceful, right?
Right, right. So first, I would say they're entitled to their opinion.
Okay.
As a Muslim, you know, we respect the laws of America. People have freedom of speech. So they are entitled to their opinion. As a member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, we were founded by Mirza Ghulam Ahmed of Qadian, who we believe was the Messiah that was promised to come in the latter days, who said there's no longer jihad of the sword, now there's jihad of the pen. So when these conversations happen, it's our responsibility to go on to radio shows, write articles, and defend Islam that way by showing facts. I think the conversation that was had on HBO where they were saying these countries, death for those who leave the original religion of Islam. It doesn't say this anywhere in the Quran. And then you go to other countries like Turkey and some of these more modern Muslim countries, and I think maybe 10 to 15%, which is still, it should be 0% for leaving the faith, because
right,
the Quran it says there's no compulsion of religion. But when you look at some of these other countries that are a little more modern, a little more moderate, you could say, there aren't these issues. I know Indonesia has women who are have led the country. So to say that women are oppressed in Islam, when a large majority of them, or most Muslim women, choose to cover. I know they say women are oppressed because they have to cover, where in the Quran it says they should guard their beauty or hide their beauty for their husbands. But at the same time, men also have to kind of lower their gaze when they walk around someone of the opposite sex. So it's not just for women. And the Prophet Muhammad said everyone should get an education, both men and women. Then we can look at Malala, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize, who's a Muslim. And the unfortunate thing is when she won the Nobel Peace Prize, she was a Pakistani and not a Muslim. So I think some of these things need to be promoted, because she is a Muslim. She covers her head. It is her choice, but she's really progressing. She's fighting for women to get an education, which it says in Islam that women and men both should, you know, fight to get an education and continue to learn.
It is not just Malala Yousafzai, by the way. There's a number of recent Peace Award winners who are Muslim.
Right. There was actually an interesting, on Twitter, someone showed a picture. I think six of the last 10 Nobel Peace Prize winners were Muslim. So, I mean, if Bill Maher looks at that means that all Muslims are Nobel Peace Prize winners.
Well, I understand, I'm not going to speak for Bill Maher, but if he were in the room, he would say 9 of the 10 Human Rights Watch countries that are at the bottom of the list for treatment of women are majority Muslim countries, and he would say the Muslim world has a woman problem, mm-hmm. has a sexism, misogyny problem. And do you disagree?
I believe there are some Muslim countries that are not treating women according to the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad and to the Quran, which it says, you know, that you should treat everyone fairly. There's also a woman by the name of, I can't think of her name. She was actually captured by the Taliban, and she ended up accepting Islam after reading the Quran. And she said, this is the Magna Carta for women's rights. So I think this is the good thing about when I heard about the Human Library. It gives you that forum to kind of speak and do that jihad of the pen, or basically defending the religion one-on-one. If I can change one person's mind and show them the truth, then pay it forward. Maybe the next time someone comes up and speaks to them, you know, it'll kind of break down those stereotypes.
Well, you've already got me interested enough not only to see you on Friday, but Will you come back and spend an hour on this program with us someday?
Of course.
Okay. You now have an invitation. I would love it. And I think this is a vital conversation. We've talked to Dr. Mohammed Shafiq and others in recent days, but I think we need to continue to have this conversation. And I especially want to hear more about Ahmadiyya, because this is a part of Islam that I'm not familiar with, and ignorance doesn't help anybody. So look, you've already got me thinking, and that's just one of the books. So I guess that's part of the point, right, Katie?
Absolutely, absolutely. This is the kind of conversation that you are having right now is exactly what participants of this event can expect to have if they come out to the event. It's the idea of sitting down with an individual, looking them in the eye, and being able to have this kind of conversation.
All right, and so Carol Selinsky is a psychic medium. She's another one of the human books. And Carol, you may have some people come out and say, help me, talk to me. And you may have some people come out and say, I want to hear you explain because this sounds like quackery, you know?
Yep.
How do you describe what you do?
I hear information that or messages that I need to pass on to individuals. It's kind of a mission for me to make sure that when I talk to an individual that needs some help on where their future is going or want to hear from their deceased loved one who just meant the world to them, it's important for me to talk with them, sit down and have this kind of intuitive information, this information come to me to pass along to them and hopefully change their life, make them happier or heal them or turn their idea around about death in general, you know. So it's great. It's great to be able to talk with individuals like that.
Are you claiming to actually be able to communicate with the spirit world?
Yes, I am a medium.
When did you think or know you could do that?
The last 16 years, it's become, I've worked on it for the last 16 years, the most I've ever worked on it. I think when I was a child, I didn't realize I was so afraid of the dark that until I was 11 years old, I mean, I had to sleep in my parents' room on the floor because I was so afraid of which I believe was spirits talking to me. And so I never really put that together until I started understanding and hearing voices that those individuals were talking to me at night, even as being so young. So and in my teenage years and in my 20s, I really didn't work on it. I was intrigued by the spirit world and spirituality and Ouija boards like everybody else, but I really never practiced it.
Are you offended when people say, this is silly?
Yes. Yeah. We get a lot of that.
But it offends you.
I fear that they're not open-minded enough to see the rest of the world around them, more so than anything. I don't take it to hurt anymore. I mean, I used to. I used to defend myself, mm-hmm. and now I there's no reason to. This is who I am, and this is what I have many individuals that love sitting down and talking.
Well, and look, from a journalist's perspective, mm-hmm. we always are looking for a great story, mm-hmm. and there's never been any firm evidence of a spirit world. And if there were, wouldn't it be the biggest news story of all time if what you're saying is true?
It would.
Then what are we waiting for? Now, let me also ask you, how do you, having just met someone off the street, mm-hmm. how do you find a way to, if there is a spirit world, how do you sort of navigate to find a deceased person who's related to someone you just met off the street? How would you communicate in a way?
Well, first I hear it's energy that it kind of, it's like radio waves. And I hear a name, and I'll approach a person and ask them who, say, Fred is. Who's Fred connected to you? A lot of times they'll say it's my uncle, deceased uncle, or my father, grandfather, and that's how it's. I approach. That's best way to explain it.
Do you need to be in a certain setting or place to be able to start doing that? I mean, you can't be sitting at lunch in Subway restaurant, right? And then
Sometimes. It all depends. It depends on how focused or in tune I can be in the middle of something. Spirit will come to me when I'm driving in the car. Quiet, no radio on.
That must be so annoying.
It is. Well, the shower's even more annoying.
I would think, especially when you're trying to just have a private moment. And I just want to get out of the shower and get on with my day, not be...
Yeah,
it's an inappropriate place for spirits.
It is, and a lot of times spirit will know that I'm going to be with one of their relatives, so they'll try really hard to give me information before I even get to I do private parties and private readings and shows as well.
Isn't it also true, though, that people want comfort? And to some degree, I think what you're providing is probably comforting. You know, I mean, look, I don't know. Maybe, Carol, you tell people, I don't have good news for you. The message is bad. You'd never buried the hatchet, and this person in the spirit world says, never contact me again.
Yeah.
I don't know, but people are looking for comfort. There's probably a confirmation bias that they may think what you're doing is sort of hocus pocus, but then all of a sudden you give them a comforting message, and there's a confirmation bias, and they want to believe that.
Yeah, when it comes to the skeptics, for instance, I had a lady at a party who said, you know, Carol, you tell me exactly what I said on the way over here, I'm going to be a believer. And the whole room, there's, you know, 15 other people in the room. And the first thing I said was, you have your grandmother's ring. And she said, oh, my God, I do. And she reached in her pocket and she pulled out her grandmother's ring. And so I gave her more information, and before I finished up, I said, and you should buy the car that you want. You should definitely buy that car. And she goes, that was the statement that I said to myself on the way here that was going to turn me into a believer. And she said, you turned me into a believer. Not only that, but you're changing my ideas on what I think of people. This was a animal rescue group, which I'm working with over the weekend as well. And she said, you know, all I think is that people are terrible people because they treat animals. How could they treat animals the way they do? But she said, you changed my thinking, my idea of individuals.
It's very interesting stuff. And I got to say, you know, Katie Pappas, skepticism is one of the sort of proud cores of my being, but at least it's interesting to have a conversation.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, even if some people are going to come in and want to talk to a medium because they want information, or some people may just want to have a conversation about how you do it. I guess the human book is open to any of that, right?
That one of the things that we try to prep our human books with is the idea that sort of everything is on the table, within reason. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if there is a question that you just do not want to answer, you are certainly...
Or you probably shouldn't have people come in and heckle
Absolutely.
A Muslim peace activist.
No. Exactly.
Or a medium.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, yeah. Carol and I can have a conversation, even if I'm not swayed, I'm not going to heckle her.
Of course.
You know, it's what
course.
You do, and we can have that conversation. It's a difference in tone.
Definitely. And after having gone through four of these events, we're very... very careful about watching for that. We have a lot of people in the area, so if you know, we know about the high sign if anybody feels uncomfortable. But
yeah.
I will say that we have had absolutely no problems.
Yeah,
I think it very much is an event that people come to with a very open mind, a very open spirit, an open heart. They truly want to learn about the human books.
Are you excited, Carol?
Very. Yeah, I like to talk.
So. Mubarak, how do you feel?
I feel really good. Actually, when I had met with Katie, I said, I'd pretty much heard everything in the book. So,
And that's probably a wide range, including some pretty ugly stuff.
Right. So, I mean, it's very hard for me to get offended. So, I mean, if there's a heckler... We do a bookstore at the public market, and we have plenty of hecklers that come by and come by 2 or 3 years, and now that person that was heckling us is coming by to talk and ask questions.
That's great.
So...
fantastic.
It is.
And those are the moments of change. So
exactly.
Just such an interesting concept. It's the Human Library, and it's 2 to 6, Rush Reese Library, this Friday. Katie Pappas, if they haven't been out to Rush Reese Library, tell us where to find it.
Rush Reese Library is it's really the main building on campus. You can't miss it. It's got the big bell tower. In terms of parking, you know, that can be a little tricky on campus, but I would say come early and find your spot at one of the meters. Or, you know, there's always the bus system. There's lots of good ways to get there. And there's lots of ways to get into the library, whether you're coming, if you come in the front of the building, which is sort of like off of the quad, we're going to be right there waiting for you with our Human Library t-shirts. And so it's definitely worth the effort to come to the event.
I mean, listen to some of these human books. Transgender person, transitioning to your true gender is difficult enough, but transitioning as a public high school teacher poses a unique set of challenges. An Afghan higher education innovator, as a Fulbright scholar from Afghanistan, this human book has lived through the Soviet invasion, civil and U.S.-led wars, and today studying American higher education policies at the U of R to build better academic institutions for the citizens of his country. Those are just two examples. You heard from Carol and Mubarak. What an interesting group. And again, I told our listeners I had to fit this into this week because when I heard about it, I really wanted it. So thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in. And thank you for taking the time. Carol, Mubarak. Have a great time on Friday, 2 to 6, the Human Library. Short break, and we're coming back talking about, well, you may have some opinions on whether we should still be celebrating Columbus Day in 2014. That is our conversation next hour.